No, I'm delighted to be back here. I actually have not been back for some years until the building was complete. So it's great to be here. Okay, so I'm gonna give a Blackboard talk because the topic that I'm doing is in progress, and there's actually probably a couple of papers in all of this stuff. Let me just tell you who I'm working with. So this is work with Patty Fox at Fermilab and Adam Martin at Notre Dame. Okay. Great. Yeah, I like this. It's very informal. It's no fancy prints. Blackboard. Should have been all Blackboard. Okay, so the inspiration. Is we've discovered the Higgs. And while we've measured a number of properties about it now, I think broadly speaking, what we know is we know its mass within a GeV or two or so, and we know that it walks and talks like a standard model Higgs to within 20%. You know, and certainly many more measurements and interesting things to be done, but I'm just gonna sort of, let's just run with this as it is. If it were just the standard model, and of course this is really secretly coming from the quartic coupling, right, the potential of the Higgs, mh squared, I probably will not get any of my twos straight, but let's see how far I can get with this. So this being related to the quartic coupling, and if I plot the quartic coupling here, this is zero, as a function of scale, that is if I RGE evolve it up to high energy scales, then it does something like this, where sort of this is the Planck scale, let's just write PL, okay, this is in sort of ballpark 10 to the 9 or 10, depending on GeV. And there is certainly an uncertainty associated with this. I've got color, so let's try to put that on. Depending on, you know, whose RGE equations you use, how many loops and how you've done this carefully, you end up with something that looks like this.
Isn't there an actual consensus now with this recent paper by the Russian guys?
That?
Carlos. What's his name? Chaturkin. There was a paper with Chaturkin that does this really cool three loop.
In top mass.
Alpha,
I mean mostly top mass, right? Mostly top mass.
Alpha S is important. If you move both alpha S and M top by plus one sigma, you can get to the Planck scale.
So that boils down to whether I take this thing matching up here or not. Right. Yeah, that's right. What I'm actually taking this from is a paper by Giudice, Strumia, blah, blah, blah. And they've written a number of papers on this. Again, this is not crucial for me, this issue of can I actually get there? Yes, there's an uncertainty band. At least in Giudice, Strumia's way of doing this, it's dominated by the top mass, at least with respect to going from 171 to 175. And then their alpha S is a band on here, but it's somewhat smaller. So that's their claim. This is what you find. So there's this is what it looks like. So very good. And people have tried to make something of this. That is, you could try to make something of it if in fact this point were here. You could try to make something of the idea that it's negative and therefore do we live in metastable? Okay. What I want to do in this talk is ask the question, is this point special? Okay. The idea that the quartic coupling crosses zero. And naively, it's not special. Certainly not special in the standard model because it's not RGE stable, right? I just move and scale any amount and this is what happens. But there is, of course, I mean, obviously there is a theory that predicts a quartic coupling, namely, right? So just a very quick reminder of how this goes. Most of you in the room probably have this in your blood, but just so we're all on the same page. If I have...
We're trying to get now new blood infusions. So, you're right, yes.
New blood infusion. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. That's right. So it's up to twos and so forth, which I'm not going to get straight. But I have terms like this in Kähler, which of course lead to something that looks like, for each gauge group, something like G, the scalar component, the D term associated with this guy, call it DJ, Q star. Okay, so I have that, you know, and so forth, the other terms. From the kinetic term of the gauge fields, of course, out of here, if I pull out the D component, I have DJ squared. This is the auxiliary field. I integrate out the auxiliary field, and this leads to that I have the sum over, let me just write it broadly as G H T H tilde. Okay, I can start writing indices here, but swear. I have terms like this that pops out of the MSSM Lagrangian, which if I then do my usual manipulations and translate, I find, again, up to a 2, 1 eighth, g squared, g prime squared, h to the fourth, and there's an overall 2 that I'm not getting straight here, all right, just because I have to manipulate. But this being the quartic coupling, I don't want to get 2 straight. That's for a paper. That's not for a blackboard. And this is the quartic coupling. So it's determined. That's the point. Of course, it's determined by a value that's not obviously zero. It's some value here. And of course, the famous thing that we now know is that this value would predict that and I should probably be even more clear. There is a C2 beta squared there. So that at least for large tan beta, when cos 2 beta goes to 1, then you predict the Higgs mass being mz. And that certainly doesn't agree with this. And of course, a big part of the community interested in trying to understand low energy supersymmetry is what to make of the difference between 125 and 90, right? This is what happens if you follow the MSSM supersymmetry. Okay. You could, however, maybe I'll do it. There is a different way of doing it, which leads to an interesting conclusion regarding lambda. And that is Suzy with Dirac Aginos. Hence the title of the talk. So here, what happens is that instead of the supersymmetry breaking mass looking like this, where this leads to then, right, F over M, lambda lambda plus Hermitian conjugate. So a Majorana mass for the Gaginos, you could instead have a term that looks like D2 theta, W prime, U alpha, J, A, J, M. Again, I'm dropping twos, root twos, and so forth. Okay, a term like this. And what this is doing is marrying off, as you'll see, the gauge field superstrength in the adjoint representation of each gauge group, J, with a chiral superfield also in the adjoint representation. So when this W prime, a hidden sector U hidden sector D term, which I'm going to write as just theta D without any indices. So when I give this a D term expectation value, I get D over M. The fermion from here, which I called lambda up there, the fermion from there, just call that psi. And this is a Dirac mass for the Gugino. So it's just a distinct possibility depending on what my source of supersymmetry breaking is and how big the terms are. And again, this has been investigated by a large number of people, several in the room and so forth, before it's for various interesting possibilities at the weak scale and so forth. Most of the sort of the issues you normally see are not directly relevant to me here. What I want to do is just sort of carry this forward a little bit. There's another term that I can extract out of here that looks like also D over M. And now I take the D component from there, DJ, sorry, the D component from here, and then real of AJ. Okay. Now, this is just to get the notation all straight. This D is just the expectation value here. This DJ is the D term associated with this gauge field strength. Real part of AJ, maybe I should put a tilde on it to remind you it's a scalar field, but it's the scalar field component from here. So I have that term. So I have an additional term that I didn't have when I did the MSSM version of this theory. So then when I add this with, well, the usual thing that would come from the kinetic term, this sort of G, DJ, H, and so on. I mean, there's other terms. Combined with this 1/2 DJ squared. So when I integrate out DJ, the auxiliary field, what that does for me is then say, well, my DJ is now equal to this combination of terms, and I'm missing probably, no, I'm fine. I'm missing something. I think I'm fine. So then I get D over M real of AJ plus this mess, which now becomes a sum over G. So, yeah.
Yeah, because you mean this D theta square or D four, the fourth theta?
D here. Sorry, what did I write? This is d squared theta. This is d2, right?
So then why
oh no, I'm just so this is the field strength, d alpha, 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 right? This is the field strength that I construct from a u1 that has a d term.
Right.
So it's just its leading component is theta d. Good. So the
You want to extract the theta squared component, right?
Correct, yep.
But lambda and psi both come with the theta.
That's right. So I have a...
Sorry.
This comes with one theta. This is... Yeah. Good. Sorry. Yeah. No, I could have written it all out, but... All right. So you have this. You have this term. You solve. You get dj is this thing plus g. Well, let's just write it as the sum of... What you would have previously called the D terms of the theory. So if I take this and I substitute it back into the Lagrangian as written here, what I end up with is one of the terms that I get is a D over M squared real of AJ squared. This is so after DL. So after doing this, substituting back in, I get a mass term for the real component of the adjoint scalar. Some D over M sum of whatever this thing is. And then this 1/2 DJ squared. And I put that in. And then that gives me more terms, but it also includes the sum squared. When I then take this expression, since I've already got a real adjoint scalar that is massive by an amount of D over M, I can go into the theory below that scale. By the way, this is, of course, the same scale up to a 2. This is the same scale as the Dirac Gugino mass. When I go below that, I integrate out aj, and what you find is that there are the d terms vanish. So there are, let me just say, sum over all of this stuff vanishes. By that, what I mean is not that the sum vanishes. I mean that I, when I substitute in and I expand this whole thing out, there is no presence of a D-term. There are different ways to see that. One way is to just start with the theory that you have here involving DJ, and then just eliminate the real part of AJ immediately. And then when you do that, you can see that the DJ also has to be set to zero. I'm saying that the contribution to the quartic coupling you get is that lambda equals zero. Okay, for D term supersymmetry breaking, only D terms. Right, and this has been well known for a while. This is, in fact, if you like, the greatest obstacle to realizing Dirac Gugino's pure Dirac, however you want to phrase it, at the weak scale. Because if you already start with this condition, you're behind the eight ball, if you like, in trying to achieve, right, this number at the weak scale, 125. But interestingly, if all of this were to have happened at a very high scale, such as this scale here, then I integrate out very massive Dirac Gugino's, and I would predict lambda equals zero. But now lambda equals zero at the scale of the Dirac mass. All right. So this is just the simple observation then that given that pure D-term supersymmetry breaking is applied to the MSSM in this way, has this quartic coupling of zero. If I had the Dirac Gugino's at an intermediate scale and I integrate them out, I would predict that the coupling would be exactly zero here.
So,
yes?
Suppose I'm in the phase of the theory above that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
What would I see there?
Nothing. There is no running of the quartic coupling above that. The only sense in which the quartic coupling runs is when you're in the standard model.
So it should just be zero?
Yeah. There are no quartics at the renormalizable level, right?
Why do you say that? I mean, there certainly is if you have normal system is connected to exactly what you say.
Yeah. The right, but now this is just.
So this condition, this possible condition, is true of all orders.
Correct. I mean, it's true. It is. Yeah, that's right. It's true at all orders in the sense of, I have not taken into account corrections that would come from threshold effects of, say, stop masses and so forth. Okay, I haven't done that. And as you'll see, I'm actually ultimately not going to enforce exactly this relation, but there will be a correction to it. And you'll see what I mean by that in a few minutes.
I'm trying to understand.
Yeah.
You know, if you really want to think that you actually have some high scale,
yep.
And you move down to that scale, is this condition really maintained?
Yeah, yeah. There's no another. The way of saying it, I mean, is simply that in the superpotential that involves the Higgs fields, right? There is no elementary. I mean, there is no equivalent of the quartic coupling. So that's it. So if you like, this becomes the UV completion of the quartic coupling being zero, is this Dirac supersymmetry, as proposed here. Okay, so great. So this is what you would get. Yeah. Yeah. Let me restate it, and then you tell me if I've confused you. So I have this relation for the with respect to the D terms. I eliminate the auxiliary field. I get some new equation, which involves the real part of aj squared. Then I integrate out this scalar. So I go to the theory below the mass of this scalar and the Gugino mass, and then there are no quartic terms. They do not exist. I hit. Precisely. Yeah. So I have to, that's right. I have to solve for this guy, yeah, and eliminate this. Okay, so.
So are you gonna tell us what happens to the stop threshold fraction?
Yeah, sort of. Okay, let me tell you. So, well, let me tell you a little bit more about what happens in this theory then. So in terms of scales, then one proposal from here would be that, say, at, what did I call this, 10 to the 9 to 10 or so GeV, there is then, there are Dirac Gugino masses here. And okay, the Dirac Gugino masses generate one loop scalar masses suppressed by 4 pi, basically, times suitable G squared, okay, yeah. So you get one loop suppressed but finite scalar masses. So M tilde squared goes as times D over M squared, and there are coefficients I'm not writing, okay? So the extent to which then the stops correct this is that I take stop left, stop right, I have them in here, and they're now equal in mass, well, almost equal in mass. They're a little bit different because of the Gugino's, but there's also no A term that's generated here either. So yeah, so this is sort of a, if you like, a small correction to the whole, to the running. Good, so this is where the scalars are. This looks fine until you realize then that not only do I predict the scalars and I predict them to be positive mass squareds, I also predict MHU squared is MHD squared is a positive quantity. Well, that's obviously a problem because then electroweak symmetry is never broken, right, in the theory. So what you have to do is the same thing people would do in split supersymmetry, right, where you have to introduce some other dynamics has to come in where I don't have this prediction and I have to disrupt this to get electroweak symmetry breaking. Whatever I do, though, if all of the scales are up high, then just like split, I'm going to have to fine-tune, right? Fine-tune a huge amount to get this to go, but it's one tuning. So I do this huge, just like split supersymmetry, one tuning, and I can make this go. What I clearly need to do, though, is to introduce a B mu, right? A B mu term, so that the Higgs mass matrix, which normally looks like this, roughly, and then there's B mu. I need to take this comparable in size to this guy's to disrupt the mass matrix and have one eigenvalue just slightly negative, right? And that's the guy that ultimately becomes the Higgs. This is just the standard stuff in split, doing in mini split or split or you simply unnatural or you're all super, yeah. That's even more, but yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So B mu, where can that come from? D terms are unfortunately not enough, and I can show you that. So if you look at the operator that would lead to a B mu term, well, it's HU, HD. I want to extract the scalar components from here. And B mu, of course, is precisely the scalar mixing. Okay, but then instead of putting the usual X dagger X over M squared, which is how you'd normally do it if you had F terms, I have to do something like this. D prime, D prime, prime dagger, D prime dagger over M to the sixth power. Okay, and you can do the counting to figure that out. This is the leading operator that would give you a B mu term. It's also, by the way, the leading operator that would give you a scalar mass for any of these components. And just to give you an idea of what this scale would be, put in the D and you have a D squared divided by M quantity squared. I swear I thought I had this in my, is this what I want? I think this is what I want. Why do I think I'm getting the wrong thing? Hang on, just one second. That's two. I'm missing some number of powers here. This D here is the same as this D here, okay, or that D there. Say what? D prime, sorry, yeah. This is why it's, okay, let me do this again. Sorry. This is, this is why, very good. Sorry, I was already anticipating in my mind that I'm gonna put D terms in. Now I put the D terms in, and I still think I'm worried about my scales, but maybe it's the fourth power. I swear I thought it was six, but okay, let's say it's four. Then we could probably do the counting just to make sure. Still think I'm off by two. Okay, in any case, it's this guy divided by m squared. So I get m Dirac. Yes, what I need to get is m Dirac to the fourth power divided by m squared. And I need to have done this properly to get this all out. And md to the fourth, I think I'm still right. I think this is... Let me just do this. It's d to the fourth over m to the sixth, which is then, right, d over m to the fourth power, bam, divided by m squared. Very good. Okay. I was confusing myself in the intermediate stuff. Very good. So what this is then the Dirac mass, so m Dirac, m Dirac squared divided by m quantity squared. And so this is then an intermediate scale, right, intermediate scale squared divided by whatever the suppression scale for m is here. If you imagine this is the Planck scale, which is probably the most natural thing to do for this sort of picture, then this ends up being the weak scale, approximately the weak scale. Okay. All right, so clearly this is not generating a B mu. Right, there is no F terms. I haven't written any F terms yet. And that's therein is the issue. So I've imagined that the model consisted only of D terms until now. Let's follow your thought. So let's now introduce F terms. One possibility would be, say, if you think about some hidden sector, like the 4-1 model from Dine, Nelson, near Sherman, okay, this crowd from the 90s, let me not describe what it is. It is a model to break. Let me just state that it is a model to break supersymmetry that generates a D term that is larger than approximately the F terms in the theory. And there are no gauge singlets in the hidden sector. Okay. I'm out of, it's gotta be, sorry. Oh, just chalk. I
yeah, a little box for the stapler.
Oh, right, the box. Thank you. Sorry. All right. So the 4-1 model has this this outcome, which means then that, of course, if I suddenly have F terms, I can write down operators like this: d4 theta. Let's call it x dagger now. X m squared. HU, HD, and then this will generate for me my B mu term. Okay, so that's fine. Notice though then that D squared theta X dagger over M alpha doesn't exist, and this guy, X dagger HU HD also doesn't exist. All right, famously from Gugino mass without singlets paper from 97, 98. Okay. So if you have this type of supersymmetry breaking sector, you can generate D terms that are of order, but in some cases slightly larger than the value than the F terms that you have. And then you can generate out of this a B mu term. And all I really need to do is to tune B mu to be, you know, 1 over 16 pi squared, 1 over 4 pi below what the D term, what the initial D term was, or equivalently that this coefficient is small by that level. And once you do that, you can disrupt this mass matrix. It will break electric symmetry, and that's great.
Okay. In your story,
yes.
This
guy here, you mean? Yeah, this is always a U1. It will only work for a U1.
So you can write down an F term for W, W, H, H.
I can write down an F term for WWHH. That's correct. Yeah, so I can write this, but I can't do the other guy. Yeah. Yes, so I could write, you're trying to generalize this term at the top?
I write the F term instead of writing the detail, because if WW is an F term, like that's something like I have an engaged net term. So I'll just take two Carl Taylor's times and write on WWHUHD.
No, that's, yeah, exactly. That's so there is another term you can write. You've already uncovered it. There's one more thing that I didn't do in all of this is in the super potential, right? I can write, still in Kähler, W prime dagger over M cubed, HUHD. And then when I put in the D term for this guy, this will actually generate for me a D over M squared divided by M integral of D squared theta HUHD, which is nothing other than a mu term. The mu term is of the size of the Dirac mass squared divided by, say, the Planck mass, so it ends up being the weak scale. So let's get this straight. So this W prime is dimension mass cubed.
Right, but the whole D term there again. So
yeah. You want to write D2 theta W prime H. Okay. Right. And what do I want to do with this?
Now you do your integral with the W prime D term, so you pick off the two D squares, and you have a D squared over M squared times H U H D.
Right. Good point. Let me think about that. Something's bothered me about this, but it's. Okay, good. Maybe I don't need F terms. Well, okay, not in the, you'll see in the story. Okay, fine. Good. Let me think about that.
It's not one of those things that you can do a chiral field redefinition and get rid of it.
That's what I'm, yeah. Let me think about it. Yeah. I mean, in the end, okay. So, oh, you can always play that game, but here I'm really imagining I'm writing everything in general. So okay, let me think about it. So what this theory would then lead to is then a spectrum where you have Dirac, you have the scalars, you have B mu through some operator, okay? And then, as I pointed out here, for this particular term, right, this guy, the so-called, the sort of Giudice-Masiero D-type mu term, okay, is you end up with mu down here, okay? And so then with this theory, you can then go and analyze some of the characteristics. Let me just get sort of one obvious piece of this out of the way quickly. So if this mu is in fact sort of weak scale-ish, then I go up to sort of the Dirac masses and then go from there. It is interesting to sort of compare the running of gauge couplings in between the MSSM and the case of Dirac. Now, the usual story is, maybe I'll just take this out for the space. So the usual story is that we have 1 over g squared is 1 over g squared plus b j 2 pi log m mu. And the evolution of the gauge couplings in these two theories is identical, except for the fact that in the MSSM, you have the gauginos going from the weak scale on up to the gut scale, or however high they go. And in the Dirac case, they start an intermediate scale and then go up. So the difference between the two theories, if you like, with respect to just the gauginos, because here I'm, sorry, the spectrum that I already erased, I should redraw it over here, has then, all right, has mu down there. And as some of you probably already know, mu is one of the crucial ingredients to the evolution of the gauge couplings. So if I'm interested in computing the evolution of these gauge couplings, here the only difference is that in the MSSM, I have sort of the difference in 1 over g squared for the MSSM corresponds to the difference in bj, so delta bj times the log for which those states go from. Okay. In particular, for each gauge group j, it's just nj, the Casimir of the group, okay, 2 and 3 for SU2 and SU3. And this is the shift, this is the effective shift that I would get going from the weak scale on up, if I consider just the contribution of the Majorana Gluino and the Majorana Wino. Obviously, the singlet doesn't contribute to any of this for the U1 theory. In the Dirac case, the same contribution is now still nj, because all of the additional components are still in the adjoint representation of the gauge group, log of now, maybe I should be more explicit here, m gut, just for fun, m weak, just so this is, you know, and hopefully I got my signs right here, but okay. And then this is now m gut divided by m intermediate scale, except that I've got more degrees of freedom, right? So I have the adjoint fermions, adjoint scalars, as well as the gauginos. So there's some numerical factor here. Again, factors of two, numerical factors, I'm not gonna try to get straight on the board. It's whatever it is. Obviously, I can also rewrite this numerical factor in that way, trivially. And so then you can see that there is a choice of scale mi such that the RGE evolution of the gauge couplings in this Dirac theory is identical to what it would be in the MSSM.
Wait, but there is an additional piece, right? There's a piece that runs from mi and weak.
Correct. Correct, but that is the same thing between the MSSM and the Dirac case if I assume that they're at the same scale. Right, that's the same, that the same differential running from that is there for in each case. So the only difference, and again, all the scalars are in complete SU5 representations, so that's irrelevant. Technically, the one thing I'm missing is there's an extra doublet of scalars that I'm not including in this. Right, because in the MSSM you have two Higgs doublets at the weak scale, not one Higgs doublet, which is what would happen in this theory. So that is one small difference in the running of G1 and G2. Okay, very good. But the dominant effect of the fermions, that's still there, and then you can sort of equate these to figure out what MI is. And MI turns out to be roughly 10 to the 10 GeV. So interestingly, this funny theory that we sort of wrote down motivated by just trying to look at what the quartic coupling would mean going down in evolution, also happens to have the gauge couplings unifying at a level that's similar to the MSSM. Now, what I've done here is just a, you know, a crude one loop matching, blah, blah, blah. When you go to two loops, which we've done, and you incorporate thresholds, you incorporate the effect of the scalar and so forth, what we find is that this, or maybe a little bit larger than this, is probably preferred. And it tends to push the unification scale up, sort of more like 10 to the 17 or so, maybe a little bit higher than that in GEV.
But here you're assuming that your eczemas are the Lego weak because of that diagram.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, regardless of whether the B mu term is generated from something like this or the term that I wrote, this is still. So what?
You can play with R symmetries. I mean, if you want to have solve a new problem, you run the charts that you need and some R charts for reading a new term. And I think that will produce that.
Yeah, I'm still bothered by it. But let me do this offline. Yeah. Yeah. So where we're at then is that there's this interesting theory, and it looks interesting, it looks nice. There's just one minor problem with it. It's already ruled out. Okay. So I went through all of this exercise to you, and I bait and switched you right there. The entire construction is ruled out. And who knows why? I'll let you think about that while I erase. Say what? No, fortunately from LHC, this is a feature, not a bug, right? Yes. That I don't call that being ruled out. That's just standard split. I'm sorry, what? Value of MT that makes lambda zero. It is sort of 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10. And there's an uncertainty there in, given the top mass that's not known, the uncertainty is between about 10 to the 8 to probably 10 to the 14. Again, if you follow Giudice, Strumia, and so forth, it may extend even higher if you allow Ereboros to increase. Yeah. Everything but one particle, or one set of particles. Right, mu. Now, this mu in this theory is what? This is in fact three states, right? This is there is a two neutral states, H2, H1, and a charge state. I don't know how to draw it, but okay. Meaning fermions, right? Fermions, the fermionic components. Higgsinos. But this H2, H1 degeneracy is, in the limit that it's exactly Dirac, is exact. Okay. In the limit that you have some F terms, H plus and minus do, but not H1, H2.
Yeah.
Correct. So what you really have here is a Dirac fermion that is made up of H2 and H1 naught. A Dirac Higgsino has a full-strength Z coupling. Regardless of whether this thing, so if this thing is stable, if R parity, i.e. if dark matter, the usual story, right? If it's stable, if R parity is exact, and this thing were a candidate for dark matter, which would be a fantastic candidate for dark matter, by the way, if the mass, if mu is of order 1.1, TeV, then you find that the thermal relic abundance, omega H squared, is whatever it needs to be, 0.12. Okay. So with this particular mass for mu, you get exactly the right relic abundance, but it is a Dirac fermion, right? And the Dirac fermion has Z exchange, right, off the nucleus. You compute this thing, you get, you know, cross-section off a nucleon is something like 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. As we just learned from a couple of days ago, we're now down at, well, for this mass, we're at like 10 to the minus 44, I think, ish. 44 at 1.1 TeV. Yeah, 44 at 1.1. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it looks like this is dead. Or, I mean, there's different ways of phrasing this. One possibility would be, well, this is all fine and wonderful, and this thing decays in some way. But then you don't have dark matter, and blah, da, da. Oh, okay. if you're interested in this being dark matter, it has to be that these states have to be split. And they have to be split by an amount enough that the inelastic splitting between these two states has got to suppress this direct detection cross-section. How would that come about? So what we thought of doing then, I don't know where I am in all this board, but so what we thought of doing is...
How light do you need to make it in order to make it completely under abundance?
So light that you'll hit the lip bound, right? Yeah, so it's really dead. It's
you can't raise it because that will make too much of it, and you cannot lower it because that then...
It's really dead if it's dark matter. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's nice to have a clean theory that is just... Anyway. There is one simple way that we thought of around this, and that is to assume there is no gauge singlet for W hypercharge. Okay, there's no singlet for it to pair off with to get a Dirac mass. So, no Dirac Beano. This has no effect on the gauge coupling running because this term didn't play any role in that. It does have two effects, though, if you suddenly say that there's no Dirac Beano. First, you can ask, well, then how does the Beano get a mass? But we already know that you get a Majorana mass that is of order times something like D over M, or whatever the largest Suzy breaking scale is, from anomaly mediation. So, okay, and there's a beta function, there's some B in here. This numerically is roughly 10 to the minus 2 times whatever this scale is. So let's call it Dirac mass, so M Dirac. By Dirac now, I mean the mass of SU2 and SU3. Okay, so you generate a Beano already at this scale. You also, though, you regenerate a little bit of the quartic coupling. Because whereas previously lambda was 1/8 g squared plus g prime squared, in the MSSM, it was 0 in the Dirac case. Now you're left with just that. Okay? And in to sort of put context, I don't know quite how to grab this one. So to put context on that, that corresponds to about here. Okay, on this plot. Sorry, it's erased, but you have it in your mind now, the image. I apologize. Okay. So it is a small correction. It's a non-zero, but a relatively small correction to what the quartic coupling is. It would then otherwise predict the scales would be a little bit lower than what you would otherwise have. Now, if you do this and you turn the crank on it, well, previously I had said this was sort of 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10. Now it goes down by an order of magnitude or so, maybe 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 is where the Dirac mass is. So again, going back to this plot, if I'm doing this properly, this is now perhaps 10 to the 8 to 9 or so. The Beano mass is then down here to maybe 10 to the 6 to 7-ish in range for the Beano mass. And then the interesting thing is that if you have just a pure Majorana Beano and you have a small mu term, you can ask how big is the mixing? And in this usual neutralino mixing matrix, neutralino, when I've decoupled M2, looks like M1 G prime V, I'm still not, make this a little bigger. G prime VU, G prime VD, the same thing here, and then mu. Okay, and if I perturbatively diagonalize this, I find that the splitting in the masses between chi 2 naught and chi 1 naught is up to a numerical factor, G prime squared V squared over M1. And now to give you some scales for this, when M1 is 10 to the 7 GeV, this is roughly 100 keV at M1 10 to the 7. Okay, so for those of you who know, 100 keV was potentially interesting for Dhamma, but that's long gone. What do you need to get to in a splitting before this Z suppression is small enough, right, so that this cross-section is less than the bounds, and the number is ballpark 200 keV. Let's not debate whether it's 200, 250, okay, it's in that ballpark. Ethan might know the number off the top of his head, but because that's the ballpark, right?
For
evading direct detection from, say, xenon.
Was it 1 keV?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter because you're going from 10 to the, you know, 10 to the...
More like 100.
More like 100.
150 or so, but,
okay. That's okay. 150, 200, yeah, I'm happy to debate.
Even your three little sums here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm happy to debate the order one numbers for that. Yeah, that's fine. I'm just giving you the ballpark, okay? So this is what you get when this mass is sort of here. But you can sort of see that this picture was sort of pushing you in the direction of lowering the Dirac mass a little bit, lowering the Beano a little bit. That'll tend to push up this splitting a little bit. So you're sort of in this interesting ballpark where you're not automatically dead, or I should say that there's at least some parameter range where you're not dead from direct detection because of the inelastic splitting. And yet, you have an interesting... fantastic. We're coming there. Yeah. I need to make one more comment about the scales, and then I'll talk about the sun, okay, if you don't mind.
Sorry, why
I don't have the mixing, you mean? Yeah, so first of all, the neutralino mass matrix is different, and the scales are larger, right? But the key is that, right, the Dirac case doesn't, there's no, this splitting is all an R, are violating effect, right? And the Dirac guys don't do that. Yeah. And by the way, this also doesn't depend on mu, right? It just depends on this G prime V squared. Again, up to some numerical thing you can compute. It just depends on M1. There's one small thing that I think is interesting in itself. So I sort of explained that mu could arise from this operator I wrote underneath the board here, this it goes as m Dirac squared divided by m, so it's sort of weak scale from that. Now if I lower the Dirac mass, I've lowered that scale a fair amount. It's becoming unclear whether that would even be large enough to sort of generate the mu that you're actually interested in. But there is another effect, which is, and this was observed by the early split supersymmetry papers, Giudice, Romanillo, and so forth. Because B mu is large, this means U1 Pecci-Quinn is broken. Which means that sending mu to zero is not a symmetry point in the Lagrangian, in the theory. And in particular, there's an RGE for mu that looks like this. Let me try to get it straight. G prime squared, 16 pi squared, tan beta, M1. And in this one particular instance, the coefficient really is 1. Okay. This is the RGE for it. Okay. So just to give you an idea of the origin of this. So if B mu is small, then I've restored U1 Pecci-Quinn. And there certainly is no way of that this RGE makes any sense. But that corresponds to taking tan beta large. So the RGE, so at least in this limit, you know, sending B mu to zero would not break electroweak symmetry, but then, of course, this thing wouldn't exist. Okay, so the limits do make sense in this theory. So this is roughly 10 to the minus 3 over tan beta times M1. So interestingly now, you have that, you take M1 of, I said, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 6, or so GeV, and then I multiply by 10 to the minus 3, I divide by some tan beta, and I get my, sorry. Yeah, well, this is what it is. So then if I mean, obviously I can solve the RGE naively, and then mu would be this thing times whatever the log is, it's some ratio of small amount of scales. So there's another coefficient here. You put that in, this is sort of the ballpark mu you get, okay? So it's of this size, which means then that for M1 of the scale of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, you not only through this RGE effect generate mu, but you also generate the splitting simultaneously, all in one go. So let me say it a different way. You could have imagined that you were interested in a model that had a Higgsino, a pure Higgsino LSP that was safe from direct detection. What would you do? You would say, well, I put in my theory the Higgsinos, and then I'm free to raise M1 or M2 in principle up to some value such that this inelastic splitting hits this boundary. Okay. But I can't take the scale too low, because if I take it too low, I won't regenerate the scale in the first place. So it's bounded from sort of above and below, if you like. And interestingly, it sort of generates sort of right in the right ballpark of scales for the inelastic splitting and the scale that you need to get to get this to go. Okay. Now, of course, this particular scale was put in by hand, but then the inelastic splitting pops out. So it's an interesting UV completion of a model that does exactly that. Inelastic splitting automatically. So Higgsino dark matter sort of falls out of this sort of picture. But I mean, you can see that all of the other stuff I did was basically the UV superstructure to sort of argue that this is the result that comes out. So what can you look for? And by the way, where am I on time? Zero. Fantastic. That's kind of what I thought. All right. How do you look for this thing? Let me just make a few comments about how you look for it, and then I'll just wrap up. First thing that's amusing, of course, is that if in fact the inelastic splitting happened to be tuned, to be sure, but happened to be right near the threshold of where a little bit of the velocity tail in the galactic halo of dark matter allowed you to go through the inelastic transition, you would see events. But of course, when you're going to see the events is precisely when you've got just enough energy to do the excitation. So you'd expect events to begin right at the June 2nd, annual modulation, where you get the maximum. Okay, I'm assuming I don't get gravitational focusing of this. So it's roughly June 2nd. I begin to see a few events there, and they have to accumulate in this way. So it's huge modulation from that point of view in terms of annual modulation of the signal. But there's another thing which Itai pointed out, because he's well aware of this, and that is inelastic splitting or inelastic capture in the sun. And actually, there are even other systems that you can look at, and others have done that for.
Well, for this, the sun is perfect, right? Because you're not able to see.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So inelastic capture in the sun overcomes this velocity distribution issue, because, right, as you fall into the sun, you go into the gravitational well, you accumulate a higher velocity, and then you can overcome the inelastic splitting. You can then compute the capture rate. So the capture rate as a function, 1/seconds, as a function of this splitting delta M. So just to put a few numbers on here, so this is 100, 400 keV. And this is in orders of magnitude now along the y-axis. Okay, it's a plot, so whatever I draw is gonna be right. So it's, all right. It looks something like this. What Itai's calculation from 4 years ago, and Neil Weiner also with his collaboration showed 4 years ago, was that this capture rate is, and again, I'm not drawing it exactly correct. Okay, all right. The capture rate is at larger inelastic splitting dominated by the trace heavy elements in the sun, iron. And iron becomes the dominant piece to this. At lower energy, of course, other elements come in and tell you about the capture rate. The interesting thing, though, is that you could say, well, this is fine. What's going to happen? Well, okay, I'll probably then I already drew a sun. I'll have a particle that'll come in, not like that path, but you get the idea. Comes in like this, scatters once through this inelastic transition, and then begins a process, maybe even through suppressed interactions of elastic scattering. This thing would then eventually thermalize, and then you could look at its annihilation rate. But that's too quick, and it's too quick for an interesting sort of reason. So let me just make one comment about the elastic cross-section. So we know that there is a elastic cross-section that could occur through this neutralino exciting to the charged state. I don't know if I'm going to draw all the diagrams right, but this is one of them. Okay, so chi 1. There's another diagram that looks something like this. Okay, and this is a Higgs. For a long time, it was sort of thought that this would be a suppressed, that this would be moderately suppressed sort of at the level of 10 to the minus 47 or so centimeters squared off the nucleon. However, interestingly, a recent calculation by Richard Hill and his student, who will forever hate me because I'm not remembering his name right now, Solon, I think. And if I got it wrong, forgive me. Okay, got to talk to the camera now, right? Yeah. And these guys did an interesting calculation just in the low energy effective theory where you integrate out the heavy degrees of freedom. This is the electroweak guys. And you go ahead and do and look at the rates for it. And what they found was that the, so this is now the elastic cross-section through the charged state as a function of the Higgs mass here, mH, looks something like this. Can you guess where the local minimum is? Happened completely accidentally, as far as we know. There is an uncertainty in this. That may not be, you know, there is uncertainty in the prediction, so there's my uncertainty band. But just to give you an idea, the number I was starting with here is about sort of 10 to the minus 49, 50. And by down here, it's like 10 to the minus 52 centimeters squared. So small that even if you have this process going on, these particles that scatter in the sun will not elastically scatter and allow you to re-thermalize. So it is an interesting, it's an interesting case that realizes precisely the quote unquote worst case scenario or interesting scenario that Itai had studied about 4 years ago. So then what you have to do is to look at only scatterings through inelastic transitions, and that completely changes the dynamics of what it means to quote unquote thermalize in this in the sun to determine whether you get to an annihilation rate that is significant. So Itai has done some estimates of this. We're actually also doing some estimates of this. We don't have actually the results yet. We have not yet completely understood how to do, well, we've understood how to do it, but we don't have the result of exactly what this looks like as yet. But it's interesting because it is one of the interesting places where if you happen to be in this sort of range of 200 to 300 or so keV, it may be just sort of the range where then the sun would be the dominant place to try to see it. But to do that, you have to understand this the inelastic transitions. All right, I don't think I'll go any further than that. So thank you. Yep.
There must be many ways you can modify MSSM to try and round it to zero to get a UV complete theory.
I would be delighted to see other methods.
I mean, this is not UV.
I am not aware of another. The only other way you can do this is if tan beta were fixed to one for some reason. But I don't know of someone who's invented a mechanism that has forced tan beta to be one.
So this approach.
It is the approach of having an exact Dirac spectrum at the high scale is dead from Lux. If you put in a well, wherever it is in here, if you put in a Majorana Beano, then it's completely allowed.
But anyway, depending on who you are, because they don't see supersymmetric part.
Right.
How does this affect your feeling about this?
For this is the joy of this and other scenarios like it, namely split scenarios. Almost all of the superpartners are so heavy you'll never see them at the LHC.
I won't see them in my lifetime.
And I won't see them in my lifetime. The best thing that you can find is the Higgsino LSP. That's what you're looking for. And in specifically, what you're looking for is that you find the LSP and you find it with an inelastic splitting. Now, when I say find, there's a lot to be able to get to that point, to be able to quote unquote find it. But yeah. It is possible though, that, I mean, with 1.1 TeV Higgsino, the LHC at 14 TeV is probably going to make, that's probably tough, if not impossible. I don't know the answer, okay? So depends on large number of issues that I don't completely understand yet. But at 100 TeV, who knows what's possible? And of course, this is what some of us are beginning to, 100 TeV, yes. How are we supposed to get there? We use the efforts that are now underway, spearheaded by Nima and Tao Han, Lian Tao Wang, and others to look at this at China.
Oh, there's also at CERN.
And also at CERN, true, yeah. Yeah, fair enough. So. Yeah, oh yeah, that's right, it is.
Any other questions? All right, so Graham's sit around the whole day, bombard him with questions and whatever later, and let's thank him once again. Okay.